two of us on the panel. First of all, Pat Birkadahl on my right. And I just wrote a really nice bio about her for another book she's being published in, and I just thought I might go through some of this information about her. She, this year, sold her first poems here to Sunstone, and we're certainly glad to have her poetry that will be coming out, and we're going to get an advanced preview because I've asked her to read the poem that I bought from her, which she wrote at a writing retreat in Moab, Utah last fall. And she is publishing short fiction now in an anthology that's coming out from Signature Books called Washed by a Wave of Wind, Stories from the Corridor, a science fiction story. She wrote a play based on this story that won honorable mention in the BYU Mayhew contest. She's worked as a correspondent and staff writer for four Utah newspapers and the Associated Press, and she's written over 400 articles, many of them under the byline Pat Birkadahl. So she's had an extensive career writing in journalism, and I was just thinking this morning about all the writers who started that way, everyone from Hemingway to Edgar Allan Poe to all kinds of people, so I think that's great. She's written four novels. They're currently sent out to publishers. She has chaired the 1989 BYU Science Fiction Symposium, Life, the Universe, and Everything, which is an enormous amount of work. Did a wonderful job with that. She has a BS degree in economics from George Mason University, where she received the Wall Street Journal Award for Excellence in Economics, and she's now writing her fifth novel. So thank you, Pat, for being here. B.J. Fogg, on the right of Pat, has published poetry now in Sunstone and all kinds of other places, the Sierra Nevada College Review, Dialogue, the AML Newsletter, Inscape, the Wasatch Review International. He's got some great poems coming out in other places. I was just looking here, the Summer Games in the Sierra Nevada College Review, Spring 91 is one to maybe go and look up. He's also written a lot of essays and has published essays extensively in some 9 or 10 different magazines and journals. And he's won all kinds of awards for his essays and his writing. He won the Brigham Young University Annual McKay Essay Contest 5 out of the first 6 years of the contest. He was telling me how other people who entered the contest were, I guess, glad to see him graduate and go to Stanford, because which is where he's going this fall, so they might have a chance to win. In 90 and 91, he won the BYU Portfolio Contest. In 92, he received the honorable mention, or an honorable mention, in the 34th Annual Utah Original Writing Competition, sponsored by the Utah Arts Council in the essay category. He's got BAs and master's degrees in English, both from BYU. And as I said, he's going to enter a PhD program this fall in communications at Stanford. And BJ's done a lot of really interesting things, including Backpack Around the World in 1986. And he was telling me he's been in over 40 countries. And then David Knowlton here on my left, who has been the center of swirling controversy this spring and summer. And we're sorry for everything that's happened there. That's been quite a story. And has been a professor at BYU and for years, and has done fine scholarly work there and by all standards, and has started publishing poetry. Last year, in this calendar year, I was able to accept his first poems that we were able to take here at Sunstone, and some of those have been printed this year, and I hope to see more from you, because your poems are certainly wonderful. So, yeah. Before I have the poets read, I wanted to give a short report on the year in poetry at Sunstone. I thought this was kind of interesting, just some of the statistics of things that have happened. And I'm counting calendar years from symposium to symposium. From the 92 to 93 year, we have had 21 poems printed. That's down by 2. In the 91 to 92 year, we had 23 printed. So roughly the same amount of poems have been printed in the last 2 years. I've been able to accept in this calendar year 44 poems from 17 different poets, and including poems from 9 poets who are printing with Sunstone for the first time. So I thought that was interesting, including, I guess, everybody here. BJ, you were this calendar year too, weren't you, that we did your poem? So everybody here are new at least to Sunstone, though have printed in other places. Let's see. I just wanted to mention that events at BYU are impacting our work in poetry here. I invited a lot of the poets that have printed with us over the years, and who are also professors at BYU, none of them felt that they could come and read poems here. So even just reading poetry has become dangerous here at this symposium, which I think is an astonishing. I've had poets tell me over the last couple of years that they could not submit poems here anymore and haven't, you know, because they're afraid of their academic standing or even their church standing. One of those poets relented, Cara Bullinger, at first told me she couldn't, and then has given me some absolutely beautiful poems, which I think, you know, one of the significant poems printed this year was from Cara. So I was really proud of her for that. Just a word on response time. It continues to be agonizingly slow for poems here at Sunstone, and I have to apologize for that. My only answer is I can keep trying to do better on this. I made it through a lot of poems this year, and I've got a lot more backed up at home to get through. So anyway, I try to keep the amount of poems that Sunstone has in their files low so that they get printed quickly. And I think that's a nice feature. If you do get a poem accepted here, it generally gets printed very quickly. Much faster than it would in most other markets that you'd ever submit to. It can take often a year or year and a half to hear back from professional markets, and then can take maybe up to another 2 years before you see your poem printed. It's a long process, you know, out in the other world. So anyway, I think it helps to, if you get your poem accepted, to have it come out quickly here. So, and that's been the case, I think, for at least for David and BJ. Pat's is still to come out and probably will be in one of the next issues. So that's good. Well, what I'd like to do then is have our poets read some of their poems. I've asked them to read some of the poems that they're going to be printing, or that the magazine will be printing, or that they did just recently print in BJ's case. And yes.
Is that being recorded?
Yes. Uh-huh.
I came here for information.
I'd like to have a question. No, we'll keep some time for questions and question and answer period at the very end.
I'm not sure I can accomplish anything just by listening to the reading of the poetry. Apparently, you're familiar with these people. You're not familiar with me.
Uh-huh.
I have not written primarily for the LDS market in any of my writings.
Well, most of our poets haven't, I would say.
I wanted to get some answers about your format, your themes, how you handle submissions and what happens after that.
Okay.
I travel a great deal. I'm in and out. But I have considered, and I've written a couple of things that my daughter thought I had suggested I submit to Sunstone and Dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I'm here, is for information. Now,
are you saying you can't sit through the poetry readings? Do you want me to go over this quickly right now? Or
I like to get in on other, as many different sessions as possible, but I would like to accomplish what I want to accomplish. In the
Well, I plan to have about 5 or 10 minutes at the end of the panel for us to talk. If that won't work, I can quickly go over guidelines right now, and if you need to go.
That's not what I thought this was going to be. I did bring a collection of my poetry, as I carry with me whenever I travel.
Well, and I've just invited poets who have actually been accepted here to read. You know, I wouldn't invite people.
The poets to this set.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, I wouldn't invite people from the audience, but no. No, once your poems are accepted, then you'd be on the list, and if you're local, you know, I'd certainly invite you here. I haven't been able to get anyone from out of state so far.
Poetry editor of the sorts of things that you're looking for, the sorts of.
Okay, so can we cover that in the last 5 or 10 minutes, or do you want me to run through that right now so you can take off? Okay, because you are going to leave. Is that correct?
Well, that's what I thought.
Okay. I wouldn't.
Your poetry read, but that does not serve my purpose this morning.
Okay. Well, if you're going to take off, then I can just quickly run through that. I've been trying to accept poems at Sunstone that affirm something. I haven't always been able to do that. I felt that I didn't want to take poetry that was didactic and that beat some kind of drum. You know, some kind of. And it's interesting, as you see poems submitted, there are broad classes of poems that come in. Poems about Mother in Heaven, for instance, constitute about 40% of the poems that are submitted to me. It's an amazing amount of poems. Almost none of them are printable, you know, because they're didactic diatribes. And
I've very long one on that subject.
I've printed some. Carol Clark Otteson wrote some beautiful, very moving poems on that subject, and I've printed her poems. And I've taken some from Laura Hamblin, on that same subject, you know. So I'm not saying that I'm against the subject. I'm just pointing out that there are broad categories out there that come in. Another broad category is authoritarianism in the church. You know, I see a lot of poems on that. Again, they tend to be didactic and dreadful. I prefer to see poems about poems that would be more, I guess, traditional in the sense that they deal with some small thing. They concentrate on one object. They try to maybe affirm some good thing in life. I don't know. I'm not always able to take poems like that. You know, I've certainly taken all kinds of poems, but that would be kind of what I'm looking for. I tend to shy away from formal poetry. I have taken formal poetry. I've taken sonnets. I've taken villanelles. You know, I think form in the last half of the 20th century is a kind of touchy thing to deal with. It needs to be brilliant if you're going to submit it in form, I think. And I think it's charming, it's sweet, it's a little old-fashioned, you know. It's nice to read poems too from 200 years ago that are sonnets and so on. I mean, I love sonnets, but I think today there's, you know, we've kind of moved on in the world. And so most of the vast majority of the poems I've taken are free verse. And I think we've printed some very significant poems over the years. It's great.
But I thought perhaps if you could hear some of just a couple of samples of what I've written that might give you an impression, and then you can give me a response.
That we'd have to do after the panel.
Would you rather we do that one on one?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. That'd be best to do after the panel.
All right. So. I shall excuse myself.
Okay.
Enjoy yourself.
Did that answer your question about submissions?
Yes, that gives me some.
Okay. All right, sounds good. Just send your poems to the Sunstone office, and they send them over to me, and I'll try to get back as quickly as possible.
Perhaps I'll try to come back toward the end.
Okay, all right.
And you're here until 11?
Until 11. Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right, well, let's move on to the poems then, which are the main and the best part of this panel. And let's just start, I think, with BJ and work our way down. What I'd like to ask everyone to do is read one poem, and then we'll just go down the row and then come back and read some more poems.
I think what I'll do is start out with a poem that called Aram's Visit. And I think I'm starting out with this for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think it gives some inkling about, I think, how I became really interested or something in becoming interested in language and writing. And also, I think, reflects where I come from, which is the San Joaquin Valley in California. Aram's Visit. In fourth grade homeroom, Ms. Bondietti told us to welcome our guest, William Saroyan, author of My Name is Aram. Of course, we clapped, but I already knew him. This was my Aram who'd visit me at bedtime, now grown old and bearded gray. We sat cross-legged on the tile floor while Mr. Saroyan read to us, his words capturing life as fiery and bright as the San Joaquin sun. I can no longer keep his character straight or tell why he refused a Pulitzer Prize, but something from that man, swamped in a rumpled coat, persists longer than times tables.
This is called A Speck in Time. Stillness permeates the arid strength of land, freckled with juniper and sage, powdered green against earth-red rock and sand. Massive and solid, age-old sandstone, fragile tons of sedimentary rock, dwarf visitors. In bold nakedness, stone stands unmoving and unmoved, where millennia is a moment and my passing insignificant.
That was the poem that's coming up in Sunstone. So there's an advance preview of what we're going to get. This is a poem I've written this year and has been out at a market now for about 9 months, and I haven't heard back, so we'll see what happens. It's called Anticipating Snow. Snow has fallen twice on the valley, but it did not stay. You watched it settle on concrete and fallen leaves to block all color for an instant before melting. You know snow will fall again and not melt. The mountains are white with snow. You look up to see it, but after a time, like an old man, you let your eyes squint at the absence of snow. You look at cliffs where black, wet rock shows through. You cross streets but watch the snow. You do not watch your feet splash into puddles of melted snow. The shock of cold water in your shoes makes you feel, at once, the winter growing around you. It is not a thing far off. The anticipation of snow makes you keep looking up. You know snow will fall in the valley, that snow will cover the city, that soon, wherever you look, you will see white snow.
I'm going to read a poem that I wrote while I was actually leaving Bolivia, and I'm an anthropologist and do a lot of work in Bolivia. Poetry's been a secret vice until Shane outed me. And so this changes theme and context, and it's a very personal poem, and so it's called Leaving La Paz. Steadily pushing down the long asphalt, the plane races. Its nose slightly rises as it gradually, hopefully, slips into the air. From the window I see the flickering lights of lives, the charged mind flow by. Will they? Can they? Ever dim? No. They are mine, shining evermore in the thrusting darkness of my mind. But now I ache. I miss their pulsing charge, though the plane flies on to newness and adventure. My family calls from roots sunk deep in an arid land, where a narrow green ribbon between lake and hills keeps my ancestral stones. Two lives. How can I live them? In one I miss the other. It calls me with strength. It pulls me with melancholy force. I fight, but never can I live in just one or the other. Always between, always alone, though filled with love and surrounded by warmth, caressed by gentle hearts, I still miss all those not here. When I hugged you in the airport, I cried. You make me laugh, feel weak and silly, as if around dancing, drawing midnight flames in the campfire of your soul. But always a draft of cooler loss pulls me from your flame. Inside I miss those not around, my stones, my home, my life. Like a plane, my life flows between ground and sky. I land and refueled, but soon take off again.
That's really nice. David, have you printed poems anywhere else? Have you sold anything else?
Yeah. I've been working on anthropology.
Yeah. Well, send me some more poems.
Okay. All of
the next one I'm going to read is probably one of my personal favorites, and it's still looking for a home. I sent it to Dialogue earlier this year with some other poems that I included as distractors, you know, thinking this would be the one to pick because this was the strongest. Well, they ended up picking one I didn't like nearly as much. In fact, one I didn't like at all to publish, but whatever. So this one's still at large. It's called The Spot. My hand could still testify to that morning in church when my brother stabbed me with a pencil just seconds before my winning X in tic-tac-toe. An accident, he whispered to Mom, whose Kleenex reddened with blood. But I frankly forgave him and the graphite that broke off inside. I still buy those yellow number twos in batches, sharpen them together, optimistic as guppies. As I peel back their skins, the pencils expose fresh marrows, vulnerable like the first day in school, yet poised, with perhaps enough character for Shakespeare or enough noggin for Einstein, or at least enough sense to balance my checkbook. Or rebalance, which is precisely my point. At the other end, an eraser frees me more than any ballpoint or felt tip. I could still erase all those marks, all of them except that muted impression from Sunday quiet games. Between index and thumb, by the fleshy web of my right palm, you'll find that X marking the spot at one end of my lifeline.
Let me see it.
It's great. Oh, it is here. It is truly here. I forgot which. There it is.
You can read that poem at a larger level.
This poem's called Drunk. The three-year-old twirls and laughs until she spills on the floor to the accompaniment of laughter and frowns. She tries to stand but falls again, crawling over to get another sip from Daddy's glass. Mama objects. Shut up, Daddy says. Baby laughter bounces around the room, but it doesn't sound quite right. Daddy laughs, as does the woman at his side, not Mama. Later, between night and morning, I hear heaving from the bathroom and Mama's voice soothing her baby. Daddy sleeps.
I was going through an old fantasy novel that I had started about 3 or 4 years ago and found a poem that I wrote at one point in this little novel. And so I took it out and submitted it to Asimov's because I I thought it it fit with the death of Isaac Asimov this year, you know, and they printed a lot of things, tributes to him, and I haven't heard back from them yet on this, whether they'll take it or not, but it's after Omar Khayyam, and it's called Drink Then and Lie With Me. Drink then and lie with me to watch the stars. When morning blots them out, find time to sleep. If one star falls, remember, with dawn, all stars will fade, and we go day by day dreaming of the night. So watch the stars and mourn them when they fall, and drink until the morning blots them out. What other night will shine like this? Drink now and lie with me.
I want to take a risk. Last year, Shane asked me to read a poem in Spanish, so I'm going to do it. And I love writing in Spanish. And this was actually stimulated by a portrait of the Chilean poet Gustavo Rojas at BYU. I've never met him. I don't know him. But I saw his portrait on the cover of BYU magazine, and I was stunned by the portrait. And I just sort of sat there, looked at it, you know, really, you know, sometimes things just draw you, they captivate you. And I found myself writing. So this is called Portrait of a Poet. I'm going to read it in Spanish, and then I'll attempt a translation in English. The reason I read it in Spanish is because so you can hear the sounds. Retrato de un poeta. Poeta, te miro a la cara y me pregunto qué relación sostiene con tus versos. La una labrada de oposiciones geomórficas, los otros de coexistencia con opositores. ¿O será al revés? Tu cara me recuerda la forma de un continente con arroyos, ríos, lagos y mares, cordilleras, quebradas, bahías y praderas. Pero ¿cuál tectónica, cuál erosión, cuál sismo la habrá levantado de la masa amorfa humana? Tus versos me sugieren una lucha entre titanes y un chavalín quien como pícaro roba sentido del anonimato en un paisaje dominado por fuerzas y poderes gigantescas que nos quieren aplazar. Poeta, te acaricio la frente con la mirada y los repliegues arcados por viejas pasiones volcánicas me atraen. Me tientan, me evocan la urgencia de comprender, de pillar la clave que me iluminara, que me interpretara la traducción de emoción en arruga o verso. Tu imagen continental de explosiones, terremotos, inundaciones, ciclones, tornados y huracanes contiene una relación entre párpados, nariz, oreja y quijada, una pujanza que manifiesta tormentas y disturbios como flechazos al infinito. Desafiante estás, detrás de anteojos montados en la silla de ese continente galopante, esa cara de guerrero conocedor de coraje, compasión y humildad, rebeldía, fuerza de voluntad y timidez, comprensión, abnegación y exigencia se avecinan entre tu geografía y se funden en la dinámica de tu ser. ¿Y tus versos, poeta? ¿Se forjarán de esos minerales en el fuego de tus venas, bajo el martillo de tu corazón? ¿Salen dardos de hierro, balas de acero, estampas de plata, cadenas de oro? ¿Pero cómo distingues entre metal y escoria? ¿Cómo sabes qué reprimir y qué expresar entre las complejidades, las tensiones que siento al tocar tu frente con la mirada, poeta? Tu boca callada se me hace a punto de estallar en versos. Los traes a flor de labio. ¿Por qué no los lanzas? Cuéntame, poeta. Responde a mi necesidad de saber, de escuchar, de comprender, de abrazarte y sentir esos labios, susurrar los secretos de tu mundo. Deja que me ancle en tu órbito por ahora, con la fuerza de tu gravedad, tu misterio, tus besos, mi adoración y deseo, poeta. Let me just quickly attempt this in English, and just to give you the meaning. Poet, I look at your face and I ask, what relation does it sustain with your verses? The one created from geomorphic oppositions, the others with coexistence with opposition, or is it the other way around? Your face reminds me of the form of a continent, with arroyos, rivers, lakes, and seas, mountains, canyons, bays, and prairies. But what tectonics, what erosion, what earthquake has raised you from the amorphous human mass? Your verses suggest to me a struggle among titans and a little child who, like a pícaro, sorry, steals meaning from anonymity in a landscape dominated by powers and force, gigantic powers and forces that wish to squash us. Poet, I caress your forehead with my gaze, and the arched and the folds arched by old volcanic passions attract me. They tempt me. They evoke in me the urgency of understanding, of finding the key that will illuminate, that will interpret for me the translation of emotion into wrinkle or verse. Your continental image of explosions, earthquakes, floods, cyclones, tornadoes, and hurricanes contains in the relation between eyelids, nose, ears, and jaw a force that manifests storms and disturbances like shots into the infinite. Defiant you are behind those glasses mounted on the saddle of that galloping continent, that face of a warrior who knows courage, compassion, and humility, rebellion, strength of will, and timidity, comprehension, self-denial, and exigency, bad translation, become neighbors among your geography, and they forge themselves in the dynamics of your being. And your verses, poet, are they also forged from those same minerals in the fire of your veins, under the hammer of your heart? You let out, you throw out darts of iron, bullets of steel, stamps of silver, and chains of gold. But how do you distinguish between metal and slag? How do you know what to repress and what to express among the complexities, the tensions that I feel upon touching your forehead with my gaze, poet? Your silent mouth seems to me on the point of exploding in verse. You carry them on the flower of your lips. Please respond to my need to know, of hearing, to understand, to embrace you and feel those lips whisper to me the secrets of your world. Let me anchor myself in your orbit for now, under the force of your gravity, your mystery, your kisses, my adoration and desire, poet.
The Spanish is so beautiful, too, and I think it works in English. Yeah. Be fun to run that poem in Spanish and then do the English translation, in parentheses at the side. Really fun. It's wonderful to see long poems, too, like this.
Well, this isn't a long poem. This is a short one. Inspired by, I lived 2 years in the basement of a prominent BYU professor who has dialogues with himself and others. And anyway, it's called, and I'm hoping the word won't get around, but I thought I would divulge that much. This was one that was published in, I think it was Sunstone, called Implosion. I won't tell you in March that your Xmas tree droops, the boughs bending too near the earth with glass balls and tinsel. I won't complain in April when walking barefoot through your shag as another pine needle pokes through my soul. But in May, I'll say it's time to box up your lights. Your long celebration makes neighbor boys steal to hear your globes crack and implode.
That's the poem. When did that come out? That was printed in Sunstone.
A couple of issues ago.
Uh-huh.
I have several poems that came out of my journalism experience, because when you're a journalist, you've just got to stick with the facts and keep emotion out of things. Sometimes the emotion had nowhere to go, so I often wrote about them afterwards in poetry. This is called Drowning. He stands 20 feet from the water's edge, drawn there without hope. His boy is out there, within Utah Lake, his lifeless body hidden by dark water. A policeman stands back from the man's grief. The man called from work when his son's boat capsized, a big man in work clothes. One smaller could not have held so much pain.
That's really nice. You know, I think that's really true, and one reason that poetry is still valid today is that there are things that just can't be written about or dealt with in probably as effectively than they can be in poetry. So that's really good. Let me find the poem I was going to read. Last year I had a friend who had his significant other die and called me to tell me when this happened, and this is the poem I wrote when I got word of that. If a feathery seed would rise up white on winds between these buildings, if the wind should carry a seed loosed into the dawn blue sky, if the sky could hold a seed safe on the breath of wind.
I'm going to read two very short poems right next to one another. Frustration. Like dogs chasing a moving truck, we snarl at the wheels of time. Never will we stop its flow, though its spinning steals our life. Martha, your eyes call me like a warm wilderness where hope and freedom beckon, but I'm afraid, lest I lose myself in their limpid, trackless depths.
This next poem is about, sort of a technical subject, because I think a big part of me is kind of trained in the sciences, and I think very much that way. So anyway, it's called When My Father Taught Me Radial Keratotomy. My lab coat zipped up tight, I lifted the lid from the cooler where I met my patients inside. Pig's eyes over dry ice, myopic, mushiest bath beads, marbled with gray flaps and veins. The scalpels snug in foam boxes, their blades of diamond, ruby, sapphire. I picked diamond. A knife so fragile, my father said, onion skin might break its bevel, ruin its glycerin edge. The theory. I would wound to heal. Cutting the cornea deeply, I'd weaken the eye's crystalline skin to balloon like a hernia and refract light at sharper angles. The knife injury urging far things to focus. When my father clamped the pig's eye in forceps, I began. Under the microscope, my moves were not like my father's, I knew. I'd watched his hands perform shows of grace, inserting a new plastic lens or snipping fatty skin from a lower lid, stitching, while patients would chat, joke, and feel just a few tugs around their temples. My pig's eye stared up in silence. I marked optical center over the hazy pupil and cut away, hoping for 8 even slits, radiating like thin beams from a black sun. I cut the cornea at noon, at 3, at 6, but at 9 I perforated the eye, leaking quiet tears of aqueous humor. This pig would never see again.
This poem's called The Turn of Seasons. Orange, red, brilliant yellow, color morning. Each year's death, a ritual reminder that sun-kissed days will yield to winter's sting. Fall is more cruel for being kinder. 21 years have now passed since I walked your park alone, wading through fallen leaves. 21 years I've kept your memory locked within me to be broken out by leaves. Your face, your touch, your kind, slow Texas drawl. Return when the air is kissed with briskness. A season celebration to recall perfection of youth past to neverness. Welcome, winter's chilling blast, nature's nadir, to freeze my heart for yet another year.
That's really nice. That's beautiful.
This year I had a poem come out called Elizabeth I, Unseen Persephone Walked Through the Gates of Hell. This was printed in Isaac Asimov Science Fiction Magazine, and it's part of a series of poems I did about Persephone in hell, a response to some poems a good friend of mine wrote in which Persephone was so in love with Pluton and was just dreadfully unhappy when she had to leave hell for 6 months and then go back. You know the old Greek myth, how she could leave for half a year and then had to go back down into hell. And I thought, no, that's not the way it is at all. You know, that's not how the Greek myth was presented. So I wrote some darker poems about what it's really like for poor Persephone down there. Anyway, this is one of these poems. She comes again, Robert. There, another half year marked. But for her, we would not stand here in any peace. Have I told you the story? She came to me, Robert, when I was lost among the millions crushing sticks and said, do something for your people, find a way to help them. And I lifted up my eyes and saw this hill. I need a staff, I said. So she brought me one of Charon's, and I set out to climb through all the clawing thousands that thronged these slopes, thousands babbling at me in the tongues of India and Cathay. And when I reached the top, the winds blew, yet I had nothing to fly for my staff but my red skirts. So I tore off a goodly part, tied that to the staff, and held it up in the wind that blew my hair, and my torn skirts, and my red flag. The multitudes rioting along sticks quieted and looked at me, and I shouted, England stands here. And they came to me, my English boys who drowned fighting Spanish fleets, my farmers, my generals, my sturdy village women, even my poets, even Walter came. And we made this hill a little England, for the people of all the times of England, an island of safety, a refuge of peace, in a sea of unexpected chaos. And we stand here yet, Robert. England yet stands here, and will, till all the English have crossed Styx, and I, the last, will let them greet me on the other side.
changed my mind about what I wanted to read, so I have to find it here in all this mess. This is about the village of Ollantaytambo in Peru. It's a very ancient town, built by the Incas. It's one of the most impressive monumental towns there is. It's a tourist center. In an ancient town of cobbled streets and fitted stone walls, two funerals moved, one for the living and one for the dead. Behind a plain box, townsmen filed from house to cemetery, silently feeling their sister's death. 3 days before, she still circled through rising fields of terraced barley and harvested potatoes with woolen spindle in her hands. Between the walls, she'd left another cortege shuffled, snapping black cameras at houses and people, embalming their hearts in tinier boxes for strangers to see. A week before, they too had circled through bulbous cities and asphalted fields with goals and worries on their minds. Now they had crossed others' oceans and mountains to enter a different world, where exotic kings had once built empires of finely carved stone. Both groups progressed over the paved paths the ancients had laid, the one to admire and compare, the other to live and die. Between living and dead, an unbridgeable gulf defies all efforts to overcome their strident separation, except by memory's alchemy. Between townsmen and strangers, another chasm opens. No natural cause but fear and uncaring impedes dreams of common human birth from stretching its gnarled hands across that hoary hole. Along a mournful brook in its composed course, a tourist sat, denying his camera, by a young girl washing clothes. As the funeral swayed down different streets, and the water sang its lamenting hymn, the young girl rubbed and rinsed remnants of life, while the strange youth reached out with shining eyes, till differences drained in the natural strains of ancient human laughter.
I'm going to shift the tone a little bit. This isn't really a funny poem, but it's, I think, a little bit lighter than where we've been. This was Sierra Nevada College Review published this. It's called Summer Games. We spent that summer wetter than dry in the backyard pool as the thermometer broke 105 for 7 consecutive days. With my sister, I played Marco Polo, Sharks and Minnows, Blind Man's Bluff, until our fingers ached and crinkled like raisins. My hair bleached golden, like the kumquats we plucked off the poolside tree, and my skin tanned brown like the smooth pits I tossed into Tommy Muir's yard. I splashed the pool deck to temper its scorch and laid belly down to dry on textured concrete. The water film warmed up and smoothed out my goose-fleshed arms. With my ear to the deck, I'd heard crickets drowning below. When I dried out like a dead fish, my sister woke me with a squirt from the pool sweep, and I plunged back in for revenge, another game.
Well, I dug out one of my humorous poems. Follow BJ. This is called Bad Mood Rising. Okay. There's a bad mood rising, so we better get to bed. There's a bad mood rising. Mom's about to lose her head. Though we're having tons of fun, we just really got to stop, because it isn't any fun when Mom finally blows her top. You got me good that time, so I get another hit. Pat, pow, no, it's lights out time. She's coming now, oh shit. Quick, the lights, time for bed. Ouch, get your butt off my head. The door is flung open. There is a flash of light, revealing two sleeping daughters with their eyes shut tight. There's a bad mood rising, but it's extinguished with a sigh. Maybe it's rationalizing, but Mom let sleeping girls lie.
That's great. All right, I'll read a funny poem, too. This is printed this year and also in Isaac Asimov's Science Fiction magazine. It's called After 2 Weeks of Delays Above Novo Brasil. Your obrigado is a threat, senor. Come back, you say. Venha, venha aqui outra vez. For what? For bacalhada made with five-eyed fish heads? Feijoada filled with clones' pigs' tails and feet? This station has other eateries, senor, at other places that can make me sick on cheap crap while I'm stuck waiting for some bureaucrat to sign papers to let me haul your junk to Earth. I found a pig's tail and feet in last Wednesday's almoço. The tail, 4 inches thick and all white fat, senor. Genetically deformed. And the small feet, that pig couldn't walk. Your geneticist designed it to roll around in a cage and gorge itself on the piss and plastic and paper its altered metabolism craved. Get meat from trash, senor, is that it? No, get meat that tastes like trash. Get pigs more grub than pig. I threw those feet to your three-legged dog. He choked them down fast. You didn't watch. You thought I ate that meat, never looking for the bones. waste nothing? It must have pleased your stingy, one-eyed soul to cut that tail from the pig's red corpse. I hear your waste not a deus me deo. So you squeeze the bloody flesh, meant only for me, for your rich Americano. May Deus give you all pig's tails, senor, but nada, nada will you get from me. Not after today's fine bacalhada, fish heads, old yucky, no meat, just heads. You gave me alien five-eyed fish heads over rice. Your dog smelled this and limped off. I'm leaving to jail, senor. I'll eat at Black Maria's, stomp her baratas, not yours. Cloned pig's tail, five-eyed fish heads, but nada, senor, nada my streaming.
Okay. Well, in response, I'm going to read another one in Spanish.
Oh, Portuguese.
Yeah, a nice bridge.
Yeah.
This is actually going to be hard to translate, but anyway. Migas aisladas al aire disecadas, manos sociales para otros calurosas frialmente les echan para abajo. Migas tiradas sobre piedras pisoteadas, pies armadas ni dándose cuenta les muelen sin piedad allí. Migas perdidas a ratas servidas, tan rápido de vos se olvidan, mis pobres amigas. There's a play on words, I'll have to explain, but it goes. Crumbs isolated, dried in the air. Sociable hands that for others are warm, coldly throw them down. Crumbs dropped, crushed among stones. Armed feet, not even realizing, grind them without pity there. Crumbs lost, served to the rats. So rapidly they forget you, my poor little friends. And the play is between migas and amigas, and it's Mexican, where you drop the first letter of a lot of words, so the first vowel gets lost. But anyway.
What time is it? I
think it's about 10:45, 10:48. One more? Okay. Well, I think I was going to finish up with. Yeah, I'll just do this one. I'll stay on the food theme and read something. I'm sure it's a childhood experience that we've all had with our lifesavers, and it's called triboluminescence. You may already know that light flashes like a strobe when you crush crystalline sugar, and you may be able to sketch organic trees in white chalk and label sucrose a disaccharide and hypothesize why perturbed bonds emit light. But let me take you in a dark room where I'll tear open the wrapper and hand you a Winto green lifesaver. We'll tongue our candies into place, and at the count of three, chomp down with open mouths to see the sweetness of slippery blue sparkles.
Well, this poem I'm going to ask BJ to help me with. I've never been entirely successful at getting this thing to work in two voices, but BJ and I once almost made it. Yes. This is called War Doll, and it's, of course, a poem for two voices. Let me take in my small hands.
Let me get that for you.
The tools of destruction.
Sweetheart.
Marching an alien
so
land.
So you don't spoil.
To burn.
Your
choking out the
pretty
sun.
White
the smoke
dress.
Brought from my weapons. To baptize green
let
earth.
Let me do
in
that for you.
Fire.
Young ladies.
To purify
shouldn't
with the
soil
dirt.
Their hands
screamed by flames.
In this
dancing
mess.
Dancing higher and higher in nefarious mirth. Let me weep the battle cry.
Let me hold you flesh
of liberty
to flesh.
And freedom. And with punched out blood by emancipation, to walk free in my own land or to die.
Don't tell me no.
On distant soil,
let
a callow warrior.
Take care
for my sister's liberation.
Don't
from
worry.
The plain,
your little brain.
She is
about
sheltered
how
by men's labors
about you.
And must live in men's shadows.
Don't tell me no.
How fun. A poem for two voices. That's great. I'm going to read Romeo to Juliet in Utah. This was printed in Asimov's also about a year ago. They brought us here to Utah, Juliet, and I will love you again. I will see you in your father's house, and it will not matter that actors speak our family's names, our own names, wrong. You will still be more lovely than jewels in an Ethiop's ear. More lovely, Juliet, than that metaphor this audience may not understand. What hush? The chorus on stage? We must follow. But Juliet, see the crowd sitting in seats, there, waiting. What do men and women feel when they see us with our knives and potions? When they watch you kiss me, hoping not for love, but for poison?
Just trying to think which one, just a minute here. There's so many different themes floating around and so many different poem of departure, since this is the last. Tomorrow wings on a long narrow tube will fly me away. where your voice will sound from a wingless box, condensed to a shallow digital line. From that artificial reconstituted voice, my mind must conjure up rich contours, sounding among the geometry and three dimensions of your moving form. In memory will I challenge abstraction, to hopefully wrest my experience of you from the flat planes of distance and those filaments of fibrous light. I will hold to today so my ears will always trill with your voice's resonance, my fingers tremble from your flesh's touch, and my cheek be calmed by the sight of your face.
Well, thank you, all of you. What a wonderful way to spend part of a morning listening to great poems. That's really nice. All three of you have read poems that I would love to see submitted at Sunstone, so please send me some. I don't think I have any from any of you in the docket, so so please send some in. Well, we've got a few minutes for questions, if there are any from the three of you that came to hear us. I'd be happy to entertain any questions from the audience. Or any of you, of course, if any of you've got...
Well, you know, ironically, my influences are primarily from Spanish literature. And I have to say probably the person I've read the most, there are two people, but the one who's had probably the strongest influence, ironically, is Pablo Neruda. And then secondarily, Octavio Paz, although you wouldn't know that. And then also Cesar Vallejo, if you know Cesar Vallejo, this dark, brooding poet. I didn't read a poem that's kind of like Vallejo, but if I can be so bold, just very quickly, it's a very bleak. In fact, I've spent a lot of time with Latin American poets. Latin America, everybody writes poetry. I mean, it's just, they write poetry like they drink chicha in Peru or something, you know. It's just part of the stream. And this is a poem that I wrote in December when I was very, very, very angry, and it's about the closest that I can come to the dark harshness of so many of Vallejo's students. As if among tangled, pulsing, sweating, heaving limbs, my anger thrusts deeply into the moist recesses of a once-loved friend's treachery. In my sudden agony of betrayal, hatred comes courting rare black roses in hand. Their thorns bring sharp solace, a stinging passion as I embrace their master. A writhing bed of bitterly translucent scorpions, dripping stingers extended, now strokes my aching, bleeding wounds with bilious, spiteful venom. But I don't know if you can hear behind that, but there's a structure that speaks more to Spanish verse, to the traditions of English verse. I just have to admit that I'm very untutored in English poetry, although I've grown up reading it. I've just never studied it, and my experience has been so Latin that that's probably the major influence.
That really sounds South American, too.
Yeah, it's great.
Some of the big influences on me are Bruce Boston and Robert Frazier, the two great science fiction poets. I don't know if you've read any of their work. Wonderful, wonderful things. They collaborated last year on a series of poems called, well, poems from the mutant rainforest, and they were printed in a book last year, and they're absolutely gorgeous poems. It's about a mutant rainforest taking over South America and driving people out of whole nations, and absolutely gorgeous things, beautifully written, beautifully crafted. They go back and forth. They use form in some cases, but in new and novel ways. You know, and it's never just a sonnet. There's always something else that they've brought to it. You know, and it's just been really exciting to follow their work, and nice people too. I think too, some of the big influences have just been the people I've worked with, Virginia Baker, Cara Bollinger. They're wonderful poets, and it's, I think, just a tragedy they haven't been printed in more places. And I've encouraged them, you know, to get their poetry out. But wonderful poets. And you know, those are the people that I studied with in college and was really close with, and they've been really good to work with.
I'm an old-fashioned girl, and I love poetry and form. So I love formal poetry. And then I've worked a lot with Leslie Norris at BYU. I really like his work. And yes. Anyway, what I've learned to do is write poetry in perfect form and then throw it on the page so no one can tell. It's a strategy that works, Shane.
Yes, it's okay. Pat's got a great relationship with Leslie Norris. You go in regularly. This is years after you've quit going to school there, and he still works with you and takes your poetry and reads it, and that's wonderful. It's an invaluable kind of relationship to have.
Yeah, great. God, it's so funny that you would say you start with form and then put it into maybe a more contemporary format. I pretty much come from the other way, since I consider myself more an essayist than a poet, and I was kind of late coming to poetry, and until one of my friends gave me a hint. He says, look, he says, just write really compressed prose and then break it into lines. And that's how I really Yeah, it's the opposite approach. And that's how, that gave me the courage to try, because I knew I could write very tight, compressed prose and then crack it into lines. And that seemed to work. And now I don't have to do that, but that's what got me going and gave me some confidence that I could put it together. And I do mainly write poetry, I think, to sharpen my prose skills, which helps a lot, you know, that kind of attention. And so that's, I guess my influences, at least in prose world, Richard Seltzer, Roger Rosenblatt, Annie Dillard, and I think in their most lyrical moments, they're writing poetry, but they just don't happen to crack it into lines. It's just, you know.
That's great. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
An observation.
You bet.
Not only on what I heard today, but also what I heard, was it yesterday and the other poetry session?
I have an observation, both on what I have heard today as well as what I heard in the poetry session yesterday. My question is, where does prose stop and begin and poetry begin? I'm both a nonfiction and fiction writer, poetry and prose. But speaking as a poet, this is a question which I have to ask, and I have to wonder as I listen. Now, I'm talking, of course, about contemporary poetry, and I write both the stylized poetry and the contemporary form. Now, you made this comment in reference to yourself, that you started writing poetry when someone suggested that you write prose and then compress it. But what I have a great appreciation for language and for words, which are the tools for poets. More than that, of course, ideas are the main tools for poets. But then you couch those ideas into form with words, language, and then the sounds and the rhythm of words. What I find missing in so much of this, shall we call it prose poetry form? It's simplistic, but I believe it makes the point. I find lacking the consonants, the alliteration, the rhythm, even the rhyme, even if it's internal rhyme. Rhyme doesn't have to be end rhyme. It can be internal in your use and in your choice and use of words. And I find that lacking in so much of the poetry which I have heard today and yesterday.
The poems that were read here today, you would find all of the poetic virtues that you mentioned. Internal rhyme, assonance, alliteration, all of those are present in these poems. I know they were in mine.
Then
internal rhyme, off rhyme, you know, we've got all those kinds of things going on. And certainly, you know, in David's Latin-identified poems, you can hear that music. No, I wouldn't call any of these that were read here today prose. These were poems. Sure. I just wanted to mention that I do think the distinction is blurring, but there is still a distinction between prose and poetry. And, you know, certainly the successful poems that you see out there have all of the things you talked about and will continue all the great things that we love in poetry, the music.
Yeah. No, I want to take that on because I think that's a fascinating question. I mean, I'm an academic. I'm an anthropologist, not a person who does literary study, but we've been looking at things like poetics and poetry around the world in many different societies and cultures. And wherever you go, there's an interplay between all the things that you mentioned, as well as many other things. And really, there is no line between prose and poetry, nor is there any possible. The difference between prose and poetry is like the difference between Spanish, French, or among Spanish, French, and Italian. If you travel between Madrid, if you fly from Madrid to Rome, you know you've crossed a boundary. If you fly from Madrid to Paris, you know you've crossed a boundary. But if you go by land and talk to people all along the way, you soon find yourself speaking Italian, but you never knew you crossed the border. Because the language slowly changes and slowly shifts and slowly makes the difference. So there is no boundary between prose and poetry. And I think one of the fun things is just playing off the boundary so that if the formal rhyme and meter of traditional Anglo-Saxon, and I stress it's Anglo-Saxon poetry, is missing, then fine, you can play off that lack to make the art. And it's in the movement that contrasts the challenge that one finds the artistry, the aesthetics. Another tradition that I've certainly worked on is the tradition not of meter, but that of numbers of syllables with the kinds of assonance and so on that you were talking about, the internal rhymes and so on. That's very Latin, and it goes way back into Spanish, into the Spanish past, and this past of the Romance languages. In fact, people made a big break in the Romance language, the modernist period, by suddenly introducing meter. And you know what? It sounds horrible in Spanish. It doesn't work. But it was a fine break at the time. So there isn't. I just can't conceive of a boundary. And furthermore, if you listen to somebody like Maya Angelou recite her poems, you notice there furthermore is not a difference between poetry and song. There is no place where poetry stops and song begins. One thing I loved about that double poem you wrote was I felt like I was in the middle of a symphony in some ways. It was like two, it was a contrapuntal harmony of two voices speaking back and forth. There was tremendous rhythm. Forget the meaning level at this point, just the sound itself, the two different voices, distinct voices breaking and interpenetrating each other, providing, it would be as if we had two drums moving back and forth to each other in contrapunt, like African polyrhythms, or like early sort of pre-Bach contrapuntal harmonies in a sense. It works at that level. But then we can also take the level of ideas, where forget all the sound things right now, forget everything there, we take an idea and we play that idea off against another idea. That can also be poetry, where the whole artistry, the aesthetics, are created at the level of images where they can play off other images, challenge them, break them, fragment them, recreate them, renew them, refresh them. And so I just can't conceive of a line, and it's fun to see poets sort of remove their lines, recreate them, change them around, because the way it's put on the page then will also challenge the way you read it. Do you read it like verse, or do you read it like poetry? Do you attempt to find the rhythm, or do you not attempt to find the rhythm? And to me, all these things are just points that an artist has to use aesthetically to express their art. And, you know, we are in a very postmodern period, which means all things are possible. And so, therefore, we're playful, we're having fun, and we're taking everything that was ever created and juxtaposing it and reinventing it and recreating it and playing it. We're sort of renewing the world, I think.
Just one observation on this. The poem that won the 1992 Risling Award, which is the poem or the poetry award for the best poem in the Science Fiction Poetry Association, was first printed as a short story in Amazing Science Fiction Stories. So the button and what you know.
Was it manipulated?
No, just the way they printed it in Amazing Stories won also as a poem. Really, really interesting. Yeah, that a poetry organization would do that.
See, I like poetry like this, which can't be read and understood. I like
unless you see it. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. But you know, one more thing on this subject. If you look at Arabic poetry, if you look at that sort of war between Saddam Hussein and Saudi Arabia, Iraq and Arabia, over during the Gulf War period, it was a war that was fought more through poetry on Islamic radio. But it's a very traditional poetry where there was always reference to classic Islamic forms, but there was also a trade-off between ordinary language. And so there's a movement between these old forms and ordinary language. And the war was fought between the between who were the Iraqis or the Saudis could use Islamic imagery in Islamic form by breaking it or recreating it to put the other in a dependent position, to basically, to use the vulgar word, to screw the other and make the other the sort of passive receiver. But there again wasn't any boundary that could be clearly seen, because the definition of poetry or prose was constantly shifting, so that even Saddam Hussein and his massive perorations would suddenly break into poetry that have reference to poetry in the middle of other. Then he would use other forms and other styles to make another point. And the same thing when the Saudi Arabian king would get the best poets, or who are just Bedouin tribesmen from the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, to respond back in verse, this time very formal verse, expressing the conservatism of the Saudis back to Saddam Hussein. So it was really, I hear this from the rhapsodist because I don't speak Arabic, but it sounds like it was really just a marvelous, very kind of postmodern creative juxtaposition of all kinds of elements in which, although poetry is important, it was never known where the boundaries were, and that was the point.
That's wonderful. That's a good point to end on, too. I know some of you have got panels to go to, so thank you very much, David and Pat and BJ. Appreciate that.